Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Good afternoon, David. Thank you for inviting me. My name is Adrian Day. I'm talking this afternoon about the gold bull market. The thesis is, I'll give you the conclusion first, this gold market has only just begun. And I'm going to look at what the fundamental reasons for the gold bull market are, and look at whether they are likely to continue. Then I'm going to look at the equities, so look at the gold stocks versus gold. Now, some people might say to me, well, what gold bull market? But I'll just remind you that gold is up 22% this year so far. That includes the March decline, and that's outperforming the S&P this year. So this is a gold bull market. And the one fundamental, the one central reason that gold has been going up this year is because of easy money in the US. That's Jerome Powell at the bottom there, in the US and around the world. So we see, for example, there are two paths to easy money. One is interest rates. Interest rates today are the lowest that they have ever been throughout history. And in fact, today we have $18 trillion of bonds that are trading at negative interest rates. Now, we talk about negative interest rates. We throw it around. But let's just, for one second, let's just think about what that means. Negative interest rate means I lend you $100 and I am guaranteed to get back 98. That does not sound like a very good deal to me. So we have a record level of negative interest rate bonds, and we have the lowest interest rates in history. Now, the other side of easy money, of course, is the Federal central banks increasing their balance sheet. And here we can see what has happened to the Federal Reserve balance sheet over the last 8 or 9 years, and it has gone from under $1 trillion in 2008 to over $7 trillion today. I wish all my stocks had that kind of return. Now, a lot of people are saying, oh, you know what? We had the COVID epidemic. The Fed had to react. They had to do something. I want to point out, I want to emphasize as clearly as I can, that the Federal Reserve was already expanding its balance sheet long before Corona hit these shores. In fact, when Corona was simply a Mexican beer. The Fed, after pausing for a little while, started to expand its balance sheet dramatically in September 2019, 6 months before COVID. And in fact, from September 2019 to February of 2020, we had the largest liquidity boost, the largest 12-month rate of change in the Federal Reserve liquidity in history. It has nothing to do with COVID. It started as a response to the difficulties in the overnight repo market. That's a different story. We can talk about that later if you want. But the point that I want to make here is that the Fed, for the last 40 years and increasingly over that time, particularly since 2008, has taken every single opportunity or excuse that it can to expand the balance sheet. Whether it's stock market going down, whether it's North Korea threatening a bomb, whether it's Brexit, or whether it's a virus. Whatever the problem is, the Fed's answer is to throw money at it. And there's a saying you probably heard, when you're a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And that indeed is, to me, that reminds me of Federal Reserve. Excuse me. Now, some people on the surface don't see much of a problem with creating money and throwing it around. But in fact, this easy money policy has had very, very damaging consequences. Some of them are obvious, like it's hurt savers. So we have 65, 75-year-old pensioners who did the right thing all their lives by not getting into debt, by saving money, thinking they had enough money for their retirement. And now, of course, with interest rates at basically zero, they find they don't have enough money to live on. So we are turning retirees into speculators because they have to stretch for yield. That's an obvious consequence, but there are other consequences. Counterintuitively, for example, easy money makes economic recoveries, abnormally slow. We know this from the US, of course. Up to 2009, from 2009 to 2016, we had, despite the increase in the money supply from the Fed, we had the slowest economic recovery in history. And it was only when the last president came in, don't want to make this political, but when the last president came in and started talking about cutting taxes, simplifying taxes, and most importantly of all, cutting regulation, that we saw the economy start to take off. But it's the same in other countries. Look at Japan, for example. Japan has had QE on steroids for 40 years, and yet the Japanese economy has been sluggish throughout that entire period. So again, counterintuitively, easy money makes economic activity slow. We can talk about the reasons for that later if you want. Now, one of the most fundamental problems with the policy of QE and the way that the Federal Reserve engineered it was that it's widened the wealth gap. And the way it did that is really very, very simple. 2009, the Fed introduced a policy of paying interest rates, paying money on banks' excess reserves. Now, if your goal is to get the economy going and to help the middle class and the working class, then paying banks' interest rate to store their money is just about the most idiotic policy that I can imagine. If, however, your goal is not actually to help the middle class and the working class, it's to help the money center banks, then the policy makes perfect sense. And even today, as interest rates, federal fund rate has moved up a little bit, you can see that the Fed is still paying above the Federal Reserve rate, the federal funds rate, they are paying above that for banks to deposit their excess reserves. This has an effect on banks, a negative effect that they don't want to lend money. Why should they lend money and take the risk when they can borrow money, literally borrow money from the Federal Reserve at zero interest or 0.5% interest and turn around and put it back on deposit with the Federal Reserve and earn a positive risk-free return? You have disincentivized banks from lending. And I know banks are often considered the villains in this, but there are reasons that banks didn't lend money after 2009, and this is the prime reason. And so the result of this policy of paying interest on excess reserves is the money didn't circulate, money didn't flow. And you can see here how the velocity of money has collapsed. It reached a peak in 2000, but look at how it's collapsed since 2009. And the result of these policies is, of course, the widening wealth gap, where the bottom half by net assets or the bottom 50% by income have had zero gains as a group, zero gains since 2008. All the gains have gone to the upper 50% and most of it to the top 20 or 1%. Now, the Federal Reserve at first, I had conversations with Federal Reserve officials. At first, they denied. They said it was preposterous to say that their policies had had any effect on the wealth gap. And in fact, when I had a conversation with one of the bank's economists, he was looking for my tinfoil hat. And he said, obviously you support Trump. I said, Trump's got nothing to do with this. This is not a right wing, left wing. It's a plain fact. Now, in the last couple of years, in fact, the Federal Reserve has come around to realizing that their policies, in fact, have aggravated the wealth gap. And like the arsonist who becomes a fireman, the Federal Reserve thinks that it is the right institution to correct the effects of its own policies. And so we have, if the problem was created by the narrow channeling of money, new money, to money center banks in New York, and then it didn't get into the broad population, then obviously the answer to that is to distribute the money more broadly. And so this year we've had a resurgence of Ben Bernanke's, helicopter money idea, where money is created by the Federal Reserve out of thin air, and it is given directly to people. The idea of that, obviously, is to boost spending, get the economy moving again. The problem is, during an epidemic, when people, a lot of people are locked at home, they can't visit family and friends, and they can't travel and so on, people who got this money did not, in fact, spend it as much as was hoped, or as much as they would in normal economic times. In fact, an awful lot of the money the people received was used to pay down credit card debt. And in economic terms, paying down credit card debt has the same effect as if the Fed had given the money directly to the banks in the first place. The other thing that we've seen more recently is the introduction, in practice, if not in theory, of modern monetary theory, or what I like to call it, magical mystery theory. Magical mystery, modern monetary theory is essentially the idea that there is no limit to how much money Congress can spend, how much goods Congress can provide, so long as the Federal Reserve or other central bank goes along with creating the credit available. And modern monetary proponents will look at what's happened over the last 10 years, and particularly over this year, and they'll say, look, there's been no inflation. That's what the big fear with modern monetary theory is. But by creating this excess money that's not paid for with higher taxes, not that I'm in favor of higher taxes, with higher taxes or with borrowing, but if you don't pay for it, the fear is that you get inflation. And the modern monetary theorists will say, look, we've had no inflation this year, so obviously our policy is correct and it works. Again, as I mentioned, the problem is that this year, with lockdowns and economic restrictions, people have not spent as much money as they have otherwise would during a normal economic period. What's essential to understand, what I've already mentioned, what's essential to understand is the difference between QE 1, 2, 3, 4 in 2009 onwards and QE infinity in 2020. The difference between the two, the difference in the mechanisms. After 2009, the money created went directly to the money center banks. And for the reason I've mentioned, it didn't get into the general population. Today, more and more of the stimulus is going directly to individuals, households, small businesses. Perhaps not enough. I know all the problems with the PPE loan programs and so on, but more money is going directly to households with the idea that they will spend it. What we can say with absolute certainty is that the Fed has planted the seeds of inflation and the Fed is busily watering them. I suspect that the COVID restrictions have only slowed down the normal lag from creation of money to higher inflation, the lag that Milton Friedman taught us 20, 30, 40 years ago, whatever it was. It's only slowed it down. And once the economy opens up, people get back to work, people start traveling again, all the excess money that's been created, the excess liquidity, and excess liquidity by definition is liquidity in excess of the current needs of the economy. All that money will go into consumer goods and start driving up the prices of consumer goods and lead to inflation. Now, inflation, as I mentioned, is a big question when you look at modern monetary theory. It's also a big question for gold investors. A lot of gold investors are buying gold today precisely because they think inflation is coming. Now, I don't think they're wrong, but on the other hand, you have critics of gold who say, look, we've had all this money, we've got no inflation, and so therefore, you know, gold is a dead duck, and we've seen that in the last 4 months. I want to disabuse you, if I may, of the idea that gold is only an inflation hedge. In fact, throughout history, gold has performed better in real terms, better during deflations than during inflations. I've got this table from a great study by Roy Jastrom called The Golden Constant. And in this book, he actually looks at the price of gold and the consumer price index, or the price of goods, going all the way back to the early 1200s. And from 15 1960 onwards, he has annual numbers on the price of gold and the price appreciation or depreciation of goods and services. And he shows, again, you can see it on this table, but in, look at the right-hand column. In deflationary periods, gold has actually outperformed in real terms. And if you look at it on a relative basis, compared with other alternative investments, then in deflations, gold shines far and away the best. So the point I'm making is that gold investors should not be afraid of deflation. What is central to whether gold goes up or not is not necessarily inflation or deflation, but it's liquidity. And this table here shows the correlation between the gold price and global liquidity. Now, in the last 5 months, gold has actually been flat after a very strong move up from March to the end of June. For the Monty Python fans listening, I'll just say I'm with Michael Palin. He's not dead, he's just resting. What we saw was a dramatic increase in the Federal Reserve's balance sheet in April, May, and June, and we saw the same thing with the European Central Bank. And then in July, August, September, we had a flattening. And in fact, in the case of the Federal Reserve, we actually had a small retreat in the total size of the balance sheet. And because global liquidity started, I hate to use the word shrink, because global liquidity started easing a little bit, gold flattened off. Now, we had a boost in liquidity, Fed liquidity, ahead of the election for all the obvious reasons. And then once the election was over, again, the Fed pulled back on its easing, and you can see it on this graph here. And the consequence was that for the last 6 weeks or last 5 weeks, gold declined. We saw that in the market. In the last 2 weeks, however, the Federal Reserve has dramatically boosted its balance sheet. And with that, gold, as you know, has moved up again. So if there is one indicator to look at, one indicator, it's global liquidity. Now, global liquidity, of course, affects a lot of things. It affects the value of the US dollar. If the Fed is easing faster or at a greater rate than other central banks, the dollar goes down. It affects the purchasing power of all currencies, depending on how much excess credit is being created. It affects the level of real interest rates, all these things. But all these things are symptoms of the central factor, which is the creation of global liquidity in excess of the needs of the economy. So I asked a question, and I'll ask it again. With a new administration, we don't know quite what the Senate is going to turn out at, but with a new administration, do you think, this is rhetorical, do you think that Congress is likely to cut back on its spending plans? Do you think that the administration under President Biden is going to urge Congress to cut spending? I don't think so. And the corollary of that is, do you think the central bank, the Federal Reserve under Jerome Powell, with former Fed head Janet Yellen at the Treasury, do you think the Fed is likely to say to Congress, nope, we're not accommodating your excess spending anymore. You've got to raise taxes or borrow more money or cut spending, but you're on your own. No, I don't think so. So the outlook, it seems to me, with increased spending plans and with a very accommodative Fed, the outlook is for the Fed balance sheet to continue to increase. And already the Federal Reserve, many in the Federal Reserve are talking about introducing negative interest rates in the US. I'm not sure that'll happen, but federal rates, as Jerome Powell himself said last week, are going to remain low long after the economy starts to recover. So I think the outlook for gold in this kind of scenario, gold is the one asset that does remarkably well. Real estate can do well, fine art and rare cars can do well. In fact, the stock market can do well in an inflationary period. But gold is definitely the one asset that will be the leader in this kind of environment. Now, a couple of things I wanted to say about gold and gold stocks that are important to realize. Number one, gold tends to move in very long cycles. cycles. This graph unfortunately ends in 2005, but you can see the point here. Over the last 200 plus years, gold cycles, whether up or down, have tended to be very long and much longer than the normal economic cycle. There are economic reasons for that, rational reasons, which we don't have time to get into. But in fact, the funny thing is that the shortest gold move over the last 200 plus years is perhaps the most famous one, and that is when the U.S. closed the gold window and stopped the redeemability of gold and set gold price free, and gold moved from $35 an ounce to $850 an ounce during the 1970s. That was a 10-year bull market. That's the shortest cycle, the shortest market over the last 200 years. So that's the first thing to realize. Gold cycles tend to be long. The second thing is that gold stocks, gold mining companies, have leverage over the price of gold. This simplistic table shows you gold going from 1800 to 2000, which is just an 11% move, nothing dramatic. And the operating profit of the companies goes from $600 to $800. That's a 33% move. So a small move in the price of gold has an outsized effect on the profit of the mining companies. Now, this, of course, assumes that costs stay the same, and I'll come to that in a minute. The next important factor to look at, to remember, is that the gold sector is small, very small. In the middle there, that's a lump of gold. You see that all of the gold stocks in the entire world, all of them, are valued at just over $1 trillion. That's significantly less than the market cap of just Microsoft alone. And it's barely half of the market cap of Apple alone. So it's a small market. Perhaps in some ways even more fascinating is if you look at the market cap of Newmont. Newmont is the largest gold stock in the entire world, the largest producer, largest gold stock. Its market cap is less than $50 billion. Tesla trades more than that in a single day, So the gold sector is remarkably small. And as more investors begin to see inflation moving up, they begin to see the need for a little bit of protection in their portfolios as stock valuations get absolutely ridiculously crazy. They only have to sell 10% of their holdings in Tesla, Microsoft, and Apple for it to be a meaningful impact on the gold stocks. The next thing I wanted to talk about is the lack of new discoveries in gold. This graph, this table takes a little bit of looking at, but let me just walk you through it. The lines in blue are the new ounces that are discovered each year. It goes back over the last 30 years. The thing that is most astonishing, if you just look at the blue lines, is although it's volatile from year to year, the number of new ounces discovered each year has been on a pretty steady downward slope. So that back in 1990, there were over 220 million ounces discovered. Last year, there were about less than 10 million ounces discovered. That's the first thing. The second thing to look at is that yellow line. And if you take out that peak in 2010, 11, 12, 13, which was an anomaly, if you take that out, we are spending more money looking for gold today than we have for the last 30 years. So the problem, the reason we're not finding gold is not because we're not looking for it. The sector is as active as it has ever been looking for gold. We're just not finding it. Now let's switch to production. And this table shows you the annual production of gold worldwide. You can see the 2019 saw a dip. 2020 was expected to have a little bit of a recovery, but the shutdowns of mines by the COVID restrictions suggest that this year will probably end with a slight, with another decline, not slight, a meaningful decline. But one can say that's due mostly to COVID. The next 2 years or 3 years will see gold production pick up based on projections. And then we start to see in 2024, we start to see a pretty dramatic fall off in new production of gold. We know this, it's very clear. If you go back to the graph that I had on discoveries, You see, but we made a lot of discoveries in 2003, 4, 5, 6, 7. Those mines, by and large, because of the lag time from discovery to production, those mines have been coming into production last year, this year, and the next couple of years. But in 2024, 25 onwards, we are going to be relying on the ounces that were discovered in 2008 onwards. And you can see that the ounces we discovered are just significantly less than the ounces discovered in the period before that. And that's why all of the projections, this is from S&P, all of the projections call for production of gold to go down meaningfully and very rapidly after 2024. But already we have a bit of a problem, because look at the number of new gold produced versus gold discovered. I've been very conservative in this, by the way, because I don't want anyone to accuse me of sort of exaggerating the numbers. I took the highest gold production for 5 years previous and 5 years going forward. I took 110 million ounces, which is what expected to be produced next year. And for the gold discovered, I actually took the largest number of ounces that have been discovered in the last 10 years. And even at that, you can see that we are not even discovering half of the ounces that are being produced. If you look at individual companies, this table shows you the reserves of different gold mining companies. Newcrest, which is the top one, the light blue, from 87 million ounces to 53 million ounces. That's a dramatic decline, but you can see that pretty much every company out there, except for Agnico, has a decline, has a decline in number of ounces of reserves. And significant from 2016 to 2019, which are the last numbers we have, of course, because gold mining companies report their reserves at the end of the year. We have an 18% decline in the reserve base of all the major mining companies. And that is despite the fact that the gold price has moved up from 1,100 to 1,900. Other things being equal, at a higher gold price, you expect higher reserves, because some ounces are profitable at 19, but are not profitable at 1,100. So they move into reserve category. Reserve, by definition, are ounces that can be produced profitably. So despite the price of gold going up, we have a significant decline in the reserve base. Now, looking at companies, the major producers have 16 years of reserves ahead of them. So today's production rate, they can keep going for 16 years, producing the same amount of ounces, other things being equal. But the fascinating thing, or the important thing, is over the last 10 years, much more than half, significantly more than half of ounces put into reserves have come from acquisitions, not from exploration. They've come from acquisitions. And as a gold investor, this is very, very important, because it means that the gold mining company producing 5 million ounces a year, when it's only finding a million, has to go out and buy that other 4 million. And if it doesn't do it this year, it has to do it next year or the year after. So the merger and acquisitions that we've seen recently, Equinox buying Premier and some of the Australian companies, for example, are only the start. That's going to be, I think, before this gold bull market is over, we're going to see a mania in gold acquisitions as companies search for ounces to replenish their production. This year, of course, with COVID restrictions, travel restrictions, you've had a lot of companies say we'd like to do acquisitions, but we're unable to do our due diligence. Australia is basically closed to foreigners. Canada is basically closed to foreigners. So a US company can't go on the ground and look at the properties that it's thinking of buying. And very few are going to do an acquisition without actually walking the ground themselves. And so I think when the restrictions get lifted, we're going to start to see this really pick up. So where are the gold stocks today valuation-wise? And the answer is quite simple. They are very, very undervalued. First of all, you had a dramatic divergence between the price of gold and the price of gold stocks. The XAU, for people who don't know, is the North American index of leading gold and silver companies. You had a divergence starting 2004, 5, 6, and it's just got very dramatic. So gold stocks are undervalued relative to gold, pretty much the most undervalued they've ever been in history, or since we had gold indices back in the 1970s. Secondly, gold stocks are cheap by price. This is again is the XAU. 2011, gold was at 1900. Today, gold is more or less at 1900. And yet the XAU, the index of the leading companies, would have to go up by well over 50% just to be back at where it was in 2011. Now, Oscar Wilde told us that, talked about people who know the price of everything but the value of nothing. So let's look at valuation. These are gold stocks on book value. And you can see that for the last 10 years, they have been significantly lower on a book value basis than they were for the 20 years before that. There are some reasons for that. We can get into it in Q&A if you want. But the point is that the gold stocks today, even after 50 to 100% moves this year, are still trading in the lower 50% below average book value. Even more dramatic is if you look at cash flow. Other than the last quarter of 2018, the gold stocks have never, never been cheaper than they are today on the basis of cash flow. Now I ask you, does this make sense? And the answer is no. It makes absolutely no sense. It makes no sense for the leading quality companies today to be trading at 50% or more discount to where they were trading in 2011. You've got gold more or less at record highs. You've got the outlook for gold very, very positive. Gold mining companies typically are in better shape today, better management, a management focused on discipline, a management focused on profitable ounces instead of growth for growth's sake. You've got balance sheets that are in much better shape today. 2010 and 11, the debt of most major gold mining companies took on an amazing amount of debt to make marginal acquisitions. The balance sheets today are in far better shape. You don't have any hedges or very few hedges on the major mining companies, so they're fully exposed to the upside. So all these reasons that gold mining companies are better today, in better shape today. Oh, and costs. Costs have gone down. I said I would mention costs. Think about 2010, 11, 12. The oil price was over 140. It peaked at 160. And today it's under $50. Oil is the number one cost input of running a mine. So your number one cost input is a third of what it was at the last peak. The number two cost input is labor and local costs. And those are determined largely by the value of the currencies. So if we look at what are called the commodity currencies, that is currencies where there are a lot of resource mines, such as Canada, Australia, Brazil, South Africa, Chile, you see those currencies are significantly lower than they were in 2010. The Canadian dollar and the Australian dollar back then were both trading at premiums to the US dollar, and today they're trading at 20 to 30% discounts to the US dollar. So if your local currency, if the currency where your mine operates is low, is undervalued relative to the US dollar, which is the currency in which we sell gold, right? So your currency is cheap. It means all of your local costs reflect that are not that much less expensive. And again, labor and local costs, all the goods and services you buy every day to make a mine run. So if you're, and that's the second largest cost input. So your two largest cost inputs are significantly lower than they were back in 2010. And in fact, the margins of the gold mining companies are far higher today than they were back in 2010. So again, I ask the question, with all those benefits and advantages between now and then, does it make any sense, any logical sense, the stocks are trading at 50% of the price that they were back then? and are trading at significantly lower valuations than they were back then? And the answer is no. So let me just conclude a little bit with some forward-looking statements. The SEC loves this because you're not supposed to say anything about the future. But as Winston Churchill said, the past is the best guide to the future. It's not perfect, but it's the best guide. So let's look at other gold bull markets and see what happened to the gold stocks. I'm sorry about the graph. This is really awful, but it's the only thing I could find. This is a graph of the Barron's Gold Index. There was no XAU back then. The Barron's Gold Mining Index in the 1970s. And in 10 years, the average gold, or the index, was up by 1,322%. In the early 2000s, from 2001 to 2008, the index quintupled. And of course, when the index of major stocks quintuples, you know that an awful lot of the intermediates, juniors, and exploration companies go up far, far more than that. 10 baggers in this period were not unusual. And then in the period from 2009 to 2011, that's just a little over 2 years, gold stocks almost quadrupled in that period. So given the gold cycles tend to be long, given what's happened to the gold stocks in the past, given where they're starting from, I don't think it's unreasonable to think that these kind of returns might be what we see in the future. One last point I'll close on before taking questions. I should have asked you, if you have any questions, please send them in. Happy to answer the questions. And if I don't get time for your question, you can always send me an email afterwards, assetmanagement@adrianday.com, and I'm happy to answer your question. The last thing I'll leave you with is stock selection. There are few industries around the world, there are few industries where individual stocks are more idiosyncratic than the gold market. You can have the gold price going up, you can have the index going up, and yet individual gold stocks lose money. I took at random, I wasn't looking for top performers or looking for bad performers. I took at random the performance of stocks in the XAU for the last 18 months. And you can see that whilst one was flat and two lost money, three more than doubled. Up 250 to 300%. So stock selection is absolutely critical in this sector. And we can talk about that later as well. So number one, Congress will continue to spend. The Fed will continue to support that spending. An increase in Fed liquidity and global liquidity is positive for gold. Gold bull markets are long. Gold stocks are undervalued. Therefore, buy gold stocks, QED. And that's the disclosure that everybody's got to read. So that's the end of my talk. Does anyone have any questions? David, are you there?
Yeah. A few people put some questions in the chat. What do you think of platinum for the next few years?
Oh, good question. I have tended to avoid investing in platinum and palladium both. I tend to be an equity investor, and our firm, we're equity investors. When you look at platinum and palladium, you're really limited to the stocks, the companies that you can buy. And I'm talking about the major miners, because you know most of them are either in South Africa or in Russia, which have their own difficulties. When you look at them, most of them are not particularly inexpensive. They already fully discount, in my view, the price. A lot of the exploration companies looking for platinum and palladium have deposits that are too small, again, in my view, to really get into production. So I have tended to just avoid investing in platinum and palladium. One we own is Norilsk, which is a Russian company, the largest nickel producer in the world, but it also produces a significant amount of palladium. And it has a 5% dividend yield. So, you know, that's an option, but it's by no means a pure play. Sorry, I sort of skirted around your question, but I don't really have strong views on the subject. One of the problems that I see with platinum and palladium is just as platinum took over to some degree from platinum when you had the price differential so large, so too there are other metals that could take the place of palladium as a catalytic converter. And of course, catalytic converters are the number one use of palladium. So the competition is really fairly high, and it's dependent primarily on price, not on efficiency. So I'm just cautious.
Okay. And let's see. Next, George says that he's concerned about two things. One is Bitcoin draining money from gold, especially with younger people more interested in cryptocurrencies. And two, the idea that central banks might develop their own digital currency. And do you have any thoughts about either of those and how they might affect the price of gold?
Yeah. And they're really related in many ways. You know, this whole subject of Bitcoin versus gold has got a lot of attention this year and the last few years. It's a big question with a lot of aspects to it. I don't think it's necessarily a competition. I don't know why somebody can't invest in gold and invest in Bitcoin. Let me just say a few things, if I may. Number one, yes, there's been a very well-publicized move out of gold into Bitcoin in the last few months by some well-known investors. And this happened just as gold has been kind of flat. So it struck a chord with people. You know, gold's going nowhere. Let's buy Bitcoin that's going up. I always go back to basics. I go back to fundamentals. And Bitcoin and gold to me are really, although they're both anti-fiat currency, which is a good thing, they share that. But many of their attributes are really completely different. And if you look at Bitcoin, for example, it is great for transmitting small amounts of money and large amounts, but you can send very small amounts of money very cheaply, very quickly, you know, around the world. Very good at that. Is it good as a store of value? You know, I'm really not so sure about that. You know, I'm a historian by training. So let's go back 2200 years to Aristotle, the greatest philosopher ever. Aristotle, in his treatise on money, said that the perfect money has seven attributes. I won't go through them all, but it has to be something that's value, has value in and of itself. It has to be instantly recognizable and desired around the world. It has to be easily divisible. It has to be durable, and so on. When you look at his seven attributes, gold is the only thing that has all seven of Aristotle's attributes of the perfect money. And that is why gold has been money for the last 5,000 years. It's not just a happenstance. It's not just because, you know, people more ignorant than us were, you know, saw the glitter of gold and succumbed to it. But there are rational reasons why gold serves as money. Now, if you look at Bitcoin, yes, it's easily divisible. It's durable, probably, possibly. We don't really know yet. As I say, gold's had 5,000 years of history. Bitcoin's had, 15 or something. But is it a store of value? I'm not sure. If you look at the volatility in Bitcoin, gold holds its value over time. And that actually is the purpose of gold. Gold is not meant to be an asset that goes up dramatically. It's meant to hold its purchasing power over time. And there's a wonderful sort of story that one gold ounce would outfit a Roman centurion, and that same ounce of gold would outfit a Georgian an Edwardian gentleman, and that 1 ounce of gold today would get you a pretty decent suit. It wouldn't get you a Brioni, but it would get you a pretty decent suit. So the 1 ounce of gold over 2,000 years has held on to its value. We don't really know if that's going to be true of Bitcoin. So I think young people are, of course, attracted to Bitcoin. It's more hip, it's digital. You know, you can carry it around in your Apple wallet or whatever, and gold is considered something their grandfather had. I don't think gold is going to go away anytime soon. Again, we've had 5,000 years of history. If the central banks of the world, the governments of the world, create digital currencies, to me, that would serve a stronger competition for for Bitcoin than it would competition for gold. Because if you're holding gold, you're holding it because it is an asset that is no one else's liability. It is not created by the government. The government does not dictate the price, although it tried to in 1933, and it's no one else's liability. So if the central banks and the governments create their own digital currency, I don't see any reason why a gold investor should say, oh, well, that's it. I don't need gold anymore. I don't think that'll happen. Any right. others?
And so sort of like Platinum a few minutes ago, do you have any thoughts about uranium futures or equities? Or?
Yeah. Uranium, in brief, I think over the medium longer term is phenomenally undervalued. It's undervalued because on the demand side, there has to be a resurgence of nuclear power. There has to be, because nuclear power is the cleanest and most efficient source of power that there is. You know, oil is dirty and wind is very expensive and windmills kill birds. Nuclear power can produce all of the world's power cheaply and efficiently, but people associate nuclear power they associate nuclear power with nuclear bombs. So it's always had a sort of negative connotation. And then, of course, we've had two bad nuclear accidents, Chernobyl and Three Mile. The problem is, it's a bit like when an airplane crashes and 300 people die, everybody thinks airplanes are air travel is very unsafe. But if you look at the number of deaths by air travel relative to the number of deaths by automobile travel, if you look at it on a mile traveled, air travel is vastly safer than automobile. It's the same thing with nuclear power. When you have a nuclear power accident, a lot of people die and a lot of people get illnesses and so on. And so it's headlines. But more people die in coal mines every day. More people are killed by mining, frankly, than they are by nuclear power. So anyway, the demand side is very, very strong. I'm cautious on the short term, and I'll tell you why. I'm cautious on the short term because there's a lot of uranium supply that can come on pretty quickly if the price of uranium goes up sufficiently and stays at a level. And that's not much higher than where we are now. So Kazakhstan, which is the number one producer in the world, cut back its exports several years ago. That could come back on very, very quickly. Cigar Lake, which Cameco closed down, that could come back pretty quickly. By pretty quickly, I mean from the time you decide to restart it to the time you're producing could be 3, 4, 5 months at the most. So there's a lot of spare capacity in uranium, which will restrain a strong move in the near term. But if you look out 5-10 years, all of the nuclear power coming on in China, power plants coming on in China, and then I think, as I say, you're going to get a resurgence of nuclear. More and more environmentalists are recognizing that uranium is not the enemy. It's a clean energy source. And over the 5-10 years, that's going to be very, very positive.
Okay.
But, you know, uranium is one of those where there's excess supply, there's slack in the supply. If you look at other commodities, gold is one we've talked about, but if you look at other commodities like copper, for example, there is no significant slack in the supply. And so as the demand goes up for copper, as we've seen this year, the price goes up very dramatically because you can't just turn a switch and bring on more copper. It just isn't there. Freeport, which is the largest privately owned copper producer in the world, they said that their, quote, shovel-ready projects would take a minimum of 7 years from the time the board gave approval to build to the time they were producing. That's a shovel-ready project. You can't just flip a switch and produce more copper, for example.
Okay. I think we have time for one more quick question. Okay. What do you think of the Equinox gold takeover of premier gold mines.
Yeah, what you really meant was one quick answer, not one quick question.
Right.
Well, I think it's a great, for Equinox, it's a great deal. They got a good price on some good assets. And unlike a lot of recent acquisitions, there's actually synergy here. Equinox is getting a producing mine, a Mercedes in Mexico, which takes the place of the Los Filos, which has been closed down because of local protests and so on. So there's synergy, and it's a great deal, a good price for Equinox. For Premier, I think in the immediate term, one could be disappointed that the price wasn't higher. Now, remember, they're getting a pro rata share of Equinox, but they're also getting a spin-off of Nevada assets, which I value at about $1.20. So the stock was trading at $260.65, which was the value at which Equinox shares were received, but you also get a spin-off that's valued at $1.20. So people who complain that they didn't get a good premium, I think are mistaken. It's a very good premium, perhaps just not as much as people wanted when you think that Equinox was trading, Premier was trading much higher in the past. In the longer term, this is a phenomenal deal because a shareholder Premier gets Equinox, which is Ross Beaty's company, great company, going to grow tremendously, well run. But they also get the Nevada assets, which I think are going to be very, very, very well received in the market, Nevada being such an attractive place to look for gold. So yeah, I like it.
Okay. I think that's all we have time for. So I, hold on.